Intrepid Leaders, and welcome to another episode of Go With The Flow, where we talk about navigating everyday leadership. In this episode, I am joined by a wonderful Scotsman, the incomparable Jonathan O'Reilly. Jonathan and I connected through the amazing QI Twitter community and our shared passion for all things quality improvement. Jonathan is also a broadcaster and has his own podcast called The QI Guy. Very appropriate. I will stick a link in the show notes so that you can check out his podcast show. It's just brilliant. And of course, I have also sat down and recorded with Jonathan. So of course, you need to check that particular episode out. So as a Florence Nightingale scholar, you are expected to undertake a quality improvement project. And some of the conversations I've had with fellow scholars and other healthcare professionals is kind of around like, how do we do this thing called QI? And, you know, we know doing QI can be a difficult space to navigate at times, primarily due to the complexities and interdependencies of the systems and processes that we have to work in. So I thought it would be helpful to record an episode of the podcast that explored not only how we do QI in the real world. I mean, there's a whole plethora of textbooks and papers around the science, etc. But there's something about how do you do QI in the real world that we live in. So not only do I want to explore how we do that, but we also wanted to explore how we can navigate some of the challenges doing QI can present. And you might recall that we asked you for some of your questions around this very subject. And we do our best to answer them in this episode. So join both Jonathan and I as we chat about doing QI in the real world. And so from getting started to sharing impact and measuring success, we do our best to share our experiences, our skills and knowledge, and some tips about what we've learned over our collective years of experience in the QI space, in the hope that we will help you better understand and therefore better navigate the quality improvement process. Jonathan's passion is evident as we navigate through the episode, and his insights, I think, are invaluable. To be honest, I thought I knew a lot about QI, but I've learned so much more during this energizing conversation with Jonathan, and I really hope you learn something too. So let's jump in. Welcome, Jonathan. Welcome to the Go With The Flow podcast episode today. It's so lovely to have you. I'm really excited to get to have a conversation with you about all things quality improvement. How are you doing today?
I am fantastic. Thanks for inviting me along, Becky. I'm usually on the other side of this doing podcasts and asking the questions. So it's a wee bit terrifying, actually. I have to say, a wee bit nervous about it. But I'm delighted to be here.
Well, hopefully I'm not that terrifying. I have been told I can and make people. But do you know what? If it makes you feel any better, it feels really weird for me, because last time I was kind of on where you are now, and you were kind of you were chatting with me. So that was my kind of experience of QI. So I'm turning the tables, as it were, Jonathan. But I mean, before we jump into the whole kind of QI stuff, it's always great for our listeners to really get a feel for the guest. And so it would be great if you just start by telling us a little bit about yourself, Jonathan, you know, your journey into QI. I think the listeners would get a great deal from that.
Sure, of course. As we're recording this, I'll be coming up on 23 years on the NHS. I like to say I started when I was eight. not true. And I started my career working as an admin officer, an admin and clerical officer in the accident emergency department of a local hospital while I was at college, university. And transitioned into then working in the NHS full time. And the the career that I kind of chose, the path that I went down was clinical audit. At that time, my boss did a very good job at that time of kind of selling me in clinical audit and the variety and everything that it was involved in, and it kind of spoke to me. I think there was a couple of other career options potentially on the table at that time, but this idea of audit. So that was about 2004, and I started out as a clinical audit assistant and kind of moved through. And for anybody that's obviously been in the NHS for a long time listening to this podcast, audit was one of the main kind of engines of change within the NHS. That's what we did. We audited things and come up with action plans and all that kind of stuff. And it was probably around about maybe 2008, 2009, this idea of QI came on the horizon. And in Scotland, we had a programme which is still going called the Scottish Patient Safety Programme.
Yeah.
And at the time that that came in, the predominant methodology that was driving that forward was this idea of QI. And I was working audit and effectiveness and evaluation and all that at the time. And I have to say, Becky, I was a wee bit sceptical of QI when I first heard about it. And that kind of disappeared once I started to get involved and see the power of it and that the kind of rapid change cycles, which is very different from audit. You know, you would do audits and sometimes you would, you know, take 3 to 6 months. This idea of just doing it daily, weekly. So I get really hooked in that. And I've spent probably the last 10, 11 years kind of in quality improvement roles at various levels in the Scottish Health Service and some of our territorial boards, trusts, as people might recognise them, and also working nationally at Healthcare and Improvement Scotland as well. And I now find myself working in a fantastic organisation, the NHS Golden Jubilee Hospital, as their head of QI, no less. I don't know how that happened, but that's where I am. So,
well, I think
so
I know how that happened.
Well, okay. So that's a wee bit of my kind of journey and how I've arrived at where I am.
That's really interesting, Jonathan, because I actually didn't know that about you, because I don't think we've ever had that kind of, it wouldn't have necessarily come up because we always go straight into the whole quality improvement stuff. And I know our paths have crossed quite a bit. We connected initially on Twitter, the great and wonderful Twitter, although, you know, we won't get into that whole debate and the great Elon Musk and what he's doing to Twitter at the moment, but maybe there's a whole other podcast. And yes, I can't not mention you have a podcast of your own as well, which, so whilst we'll be touching on QI today, if people want to know about different elements of QI in a lot more detail, they definitely need to go and take a listen to your podcast. There's some great podcasts in there with some great guests. So I will put the link to your podcast in the show notes as well. You know, you're scratching my back, I need to scratch yours, as they say. There's a bit of transactional stuff going on here. But what's fascinating to me, because this is a conversation that I've had on many occasions, is the whole relationship between, you know, clinical audit and QI. And there's some people who are like pure QI. You get these QI purists, don't you? And then like the clinical audit is almost like holding up that cross, you know, and I don't want anything to do with that. But I don't know it would be great to hear what your view is of clinical audit and QI. But for me, it's got a cyclical relationship, I think. And they definitely work together.
Yeah, you know, I would agree with that reflection that certainly my own kind of experiences was when I was kind of making that transition from predominantly doing clinical audit to using the QI methodology to kind of drive change. I was kind of all in the QI stuff, and I kind of disregarded the audit. That's old hat. That's how we used to do things.
Yeah.
And you know, just as you were saying, I think a lot of people are perhaps in those different camps. Where I'm at now is having worked in QI for a long time, I think the maturity of that discussion and how and QI within the system, I'm now thinking more about quality in the roundest sense.
Yeah.
So moving from just a kind of QI approach, although that's really important and that's what has traction in a lot of organisations, but actually started to think about that whole quality management system approach to change. So not just the QI piece, but actually what comes before you get to an improvement activity, the planning for quality, what does good look like? You know, whether that's the evidence base, whether that's the discussions that you're having, what is it you want to achieve, and getting that kind of vision statement down, then moving into that kind of quality control. And this is where things like clinical audit comes in, and is really, really important. So what data do you have that tells you that you're achieving what it is you've set out? Audit data is a fantastic way of understanding what's happening in your system, particularly at scale, because audits are usually very big in scale. They'll give you a sense of what's happening. Lots of our judgment data or target data is collected in an audit methodology within the healthcare. So things like 4-hour targets, your time to treatment targets, all that kind of stuff is audit.
Mm.
So you have to use that data to reflect on where you are, identify the opportunities, identify the gaps, and that's what now leads into the QI activity. So you're not just doing that whole spray and pray QI approach. You're actually focusing on the things that you need to work on at an organisational level. And that's where you're going to maximise the benefit of QI. There was a fantastic tweet chat, QI hour tweet chat the other night, which unfortunately I didn't make around, you know, the impact that QI is having in our healthcare service and why it's not delivering change, or you know, what might be having a factor there. And for me, it's that bit of, if we look at QI in isolation without looking at these other elements of quality management system and bringing in these other methodologies and these other specialists within your organisation, we're kind of doing ourselves a disservice. And I think that's maybe why QI gets a bit of a bad rap, because it's on its own, it's not going to change, certainly at scale and at system level.
You've beautifully articulated that. I think that was a really great answer. Thanks, Jonathan. And so much of that resonates with my thinking. And, you know, because it's not just, you're absolutely right. It's almost like looking at secondary care hospitals in isolation of the fact that, you know, our patients are citizens first and foremost, and they come from their own homes into our services. And so just looking at what we can do better in secondary care is often, you know, so you can't look at these things in isolation, can you? You know, it's a dynamic, wicked, complex, uncertain kind of environment that we work in the NHS. And so, you know, you can't expect to use one kind of size fits all type of approach, i.e. QI. And it's really important you talk about the planning stuff, because in the planning stuff, surely that's your discovery phase, isn't it? And that's the thing we often don't do very well, is that kind of problems. You know, what is the problem we're seeking to solve, isn't it? I can see you smiling. So I'm obviously talking the same language, which is always, it's great. And actually, I think that's probably a great place to start before we even... Well, I'd like to come back to the problem solving stuff. So can I ask you to hold whatever you were thinking at that point? We will come back to it, because I think it is important. And I'm trying to manage my own chaotic brain, where I tend to go off on different angles. So I'm going to bring us back. Although I think maybe you've kind of covered this off. One of the things you suggested as a part of Do It. So I guess one of the things I want to say is why we're here. So we're here today because, as a part of the Florence Nightingale Scholarship, you have to submit an idea for a project. You have to undertake a QI project as a part of that. And a lot of my, and as you're aware, I've been through that scholarship process, and it was amazing. And you know, I'm seeped in QI, like you. I've been in QI for a long, long time. But lots of conversations with some of my colleagues and my fellow scholars, and scholars that I'm now supporting as either as a mentor or in my role in Health Education Improvement Wales. And some of this, they get a bit befuddled, you know, about, I love that word, befuddled. They get a bit befuddled about QI. And so there's a couple of things. So the one thing is, like, I'm on a leadership program. I'm not quite sure how QI fits in. So it's just helping people to understand, actually, your leadership is core to driving forward and leading change. So I think that's one thing. But I think very fundamentally sometimes people may not really understand what QI is. And you started to explore that by talking about that total quality management system. But you had a genius idea. So when I reached out to you and said, would you sit and record an episode with me about QI for primarily for nurses and midwives? But I think this will be, you know, this will be helpful for lots and lots of people who are looking to do a QI project. And your suggestion was to put something out on Twitter asking people for questions, which I thought was a genius idea. And we have had a handful of questions. And I think at this seems like an opportune moment to bring one in from a lady called Jessica Pidcock, who's a student nurse. And I don't think she was necessarily submitting a question for the podcast, but she just said, can somebody tell me what QI is? I'm assuming it's not the BBC programme, although that is a very good programme. And I just thought, what a great place to start. So how would you describe quality improvement to somebody? I know you've made a start in talking about that total quality management system, but how would you describe QI, Jonathan?
I don't know if that makes me Stephen Fry or Sandy Toss.
Okay. Either's good.
I'll take either. So how would I describe QI? So quality. So we have expected standards of quality in healthcare, and some of that comes from our evidence base and our guidelines and our, you know, descriptions of how we should do things. And that can be interpreted fairly subjectively. We might all have a different understanding of what quality looks like. But the business of improving that quality is a little bit more kind of structured and standard. So I think the Health Foundation, 2014, I think they defined it, and I'm paraphrasing, but it's along the lines of using a kind of a specific methodology and set of tools to improve that quality. So that's kind of what quality improvement is in a nutshell. And using rapid cycles of kind of learning and understanding what works to improve the reliability, the safety, the, you know, timeliness, all of those kind of dimensions of quality. And now I would add sustainability as a seventh pillar of quality as well, related to the climate change kind of emergency, because I think that's really important. But QI is our way of how do we take a very specific structure methodology, way of thinking to improve that within healthcare.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great explanation. And I think there's something new around language. And I think one of the other questions maybe talked a little bit around that QI language and how we make that a little bit more digestible, I suppose, for people so that they don't see it as something that's unattainable, I think, sometimes. It's a bit like nurses and research. So nurses, we always struggle to get nurses actively engaged and interested in research. And I truly believe, and speaking again to colleagues, that some of that is around language. It can be off-putting when you use all of this kind of big language acronyms. But I guess that's no different to patients who experience our systems when we're talking in acronyms and jargon. And God knows what else. So, you know, we often make a concerted effort not to do that with our patients. So maybe we need to do the same thing when we're talking about specialised areas within the health service like QI or research or whatever else. So I'm going to bring us back now, I think. So I think that was a great explanation of what QI is. And I'm going to bring us back to that kind of problem solving thing. Because I think the next natural step for me seems to be like, okay, so we understand what QI is. How and where do we get started? And for me, it's always about, well, what is the problem that you're seeking to solve? So I'm going to take us back to that kind of like that problem solving conversation, if that's okay.
Yeah, sure. So I would say there's maybe a step before that.
Okay, yeah.
And it's really simple and it's really easy. Find yourself some pals. It's a good Scottish word. For friends, for friends, colleagues, peers, pals. Get yourself some pals. You can't do QI in isolation yourself. No. And this is an important point related to what you said earlier, Becky. People do go, and their first exposure to QI may be a leadership programme or a QI programme where they're asked to do a project. And therefore it feels very personal and very kind of, you know, I have to do this. But the first step of kind of improving any system, no matter what methodology you're using, is identify your stakeholders. Who's directly impacted by what it is you feel that you need to change, would like to change? Who's indirectly impacted in that? Who might be impacted downstream in your hospital or another part of your system, and get them together. And what that's going to do is it's going to strengthen that next step that you might come to, which is A, building the will and create the conditions for that change to happen by talking about it with people. But importantly, when you begin to understand your system and your problem, you're getting that from multiple perspectives, multiple professional perspectives. But also, actually, if you've got the opportunity, get the patients involved at this stage. Absolutely get the patients involved. So one of the kind of models that we use in QI that will be familiar to everybody is the model for improvement. And everybody knows that as three questions and the PDSA cycle. I like to use the model for improvement plus. So I like to be different, which will be no surprise to anybody that knows me. But there's a number of other organisations across the UK that are using a model for improvement plus, if you like, both in healthcare and in academia and different areas. And essentially, it's adding that first question, which is, do you understand your system and your problem? And being explicit about that. Some people will say, well, that's kind of implied in that whole, what is it you hope to accomplish? Your aim setting, perhaps. But I think it needs to be explicitly up there. So for me, that's the first question that we should be answering through that framework or any framework or methodology, because how can you then set an effective, realistic, achievable aim that's going to then feed into your theory of change and all that kind of stuff? If you don't have that understanding, if you don't do that, then you might go up a side street, as they say. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that we're opening up a completely different set of tools. There's lots of tools that we use within QI that will help you understand your system, that will help you define that problem, like process mapping, fishbone diagrams, force field analysis, understanding all the components of your system. But it's also a great way to start linking up QI and that model for improvement methodology with other approaches to change. So service design, the double diamond. You think of that first diamond, that discover and define, that comes into that question. If we think of human factors and ergonomics, depending on what the problem is, they have tools, the SEEPs tool, the system engineering and patient safety tool, allowing you to look at your system, Acumaps tool. So you can start to bring in other methodologies before you kind of move on and use the model for improvement. And that's really, really important, because I think people are now looking beyond just QI, as we've mentioned, with not only quality management, but actually other ways that we can bring this in. So that would be, I mean, that's a long-winded way of saying, my two bullet points are get some pals and sit down and really understand what your problem is from as many perspectives as you can, so that as you move forward with your improvement activities, you've got a high degree of confidence that you're focused on the right things and you've got the right ideas and the right people involved.
You're like my kindred QI spirit, fair play. It's the thing that I always talk about, and I never know which way quite to put them around, but I think you're probably right. You need the pal. It doesn't matter as long as you do that, pals. And I like the whole idea of the model for improvement plus, because I think there are other things that we often don't explicitly cover off in the model for improvement. So there's something you're about project management skills, because actually it's not so easy to convene people. So we talk about pals and having people that we need to, and I completely agree with that, because it's that whole chaos theory thing, isn't it? When you drop a pebble, I know they describe it as a butterfly flapping its wings, but it's that whole like, where is your, is that change potentially going to hit, and who do you need to kind of keep in that circle, isn't it? So I think,
Yeah,
change creates
absolutely.
ripples, doesn't it? You need to.
Yeah, Absolutely, and there's other tools that you can consider. There's the RACI tool, to look at who within your system needs to be kind of responsible for some of your actions, who needs to be accountable, who needs to be consulted, who needs to be informed, so that you can look at that whole system. When we're doing improvement, and I know this is kind of jumping ahead, but I think one of the areas that we have for the biggest areas we have for kind of development and growth around QI, and I think it would perhaps get a lot of certainly senior and executive staff on board in terms of the power of QI, is scalability of change. And we don't do that particularly well. And I think that, in my experience, is often because we don't think about that until we've done the initial pilot work. And we have a set of interventions, and we have a theory of change that we're now selling that to people. And there could be a bit of resistance if folk haven't been involved, or depending on where that source is, of improvement is perceived. So getting those folk actually involved at the start, you might not need them to do anything, but you need to know that we are doing this for the betterment of the whole system, and we're going to keep you involved, and we're going to play you in at certain points, so that when we do that kind of scale up. The other point I wanted to make there was about the model for improvement. What we've got right now in terms of the model for improvement, that three questions in the PDSA cycle, that's basically kind of 30 years of development. And I had a correspondence with Lloyd Provost, one of the kind of the authors of that, as part of the Associates for Process Improvement, and had kind of said, I think it needs a fourth question, Lloyd. Who am I to say that to him? But I said, I think this needs a fourth question. And we had a bit of an email exchange. And as part of that, he shared some graphics with me of how the model has improved over, or changed rather, over 30 odd years. That question around understanding your system and your problem was in there in the past. It's been
Oh,
in and taken out,
really?
and taken out. So, I think I feel justified in adding it, and I feel justified in kind of concentrating my QI teaching with people to say this is your first step, and it's really, really crucial. And depending on the scale of your improvement, board based, it might be based on a department looking at a single process, or it could be a massive organizational. I think you want to give that a fair chunk of time to happen. I would probably say at least kind of 6 to 8 weeks if you're looking at a big kind of a project in terms of pulling people together and looking at all the information you can to understand where you are in your system. But it might only take an hour or two at a very kind of micro system level. But the message is, give it the time that it needs, because it's going to do you well when you're moving forward.
I couldn't agree more with that. And as you're talking, there's a couple of things that come to mind. So in terms of the problem thing, and it's terrible because I'm not very good at, I always, when I don't always forget, often I'm very good at remembering who quoted what. But I know that there was a guy as part of the Apollo 13 stuff when that was going on. And when he's famously quoted as saying, let's work the problem, people, let's not make it worse by guessing. And so I love that because that just surmises for me beautifully what you've just beautifully articulated in terms of the importance of and I'm with you. Let's add that. Let's start a QI revolution, Jonathan. Let's start the model for improvement plus and add in that question because I think you're absolutely spot on. It's essential because, so many projects fail as a result of not having spent that time. And of course, the other well-known quote is the Albert Einstein quote, given an hour to save the world, I'd spend 55 minutes trying to understand what the problem was and 5 minutes solving it. So you're absolutely spot on. And I think what you've just done is beautifully described. And I'm hoping incite some reflection in some of our listeners around how many, ta how, why, if they've been involved in QI and it's not worked well, I wonder how many projects have failed as a result of people thinking they had to do it alone. And have, do you know what I mean? And gone
Absolutely.
off and kind of tried to do it alone.
Absolutely. And you know what? That's the role of leaders and leadership within QI. The role of a leader is not necessarily to actually do the change and do the activity, but the role of the leader is to bring that team together and make sure they have the right players to give them the time that they need to understand the system to make those changes, and the protection to learn from their successes and their failures as they're going along on the journey to making that improvement and that change for the betterment of the system. So, you know, that is the kind of role of leadership. And if you are kind of, you know, sitting there thinking, well, you know, where do I start? I'm just in my own, getting that sponsorship, that mentorship from a senior leader. It could be your senior charge nurse in your ward, or your senior midwife in your ward. It could be your associate director of nursing, or whoever it would be related to you. But getting that leadership buy-in is really, really important to QI.
Yeah, no, I agree, because they, you know, and hierarchy is alive and kicking, as we know. And so sometimes, you know, that sponsorship stuff is essential, isn't it, to be able to kind of do some of that unlocking and having somebody that you can escalate things to. That it's that leading beyond authority stuff, isn't it? It's like, I've got the resource, but I haven't necessarily got the authority to do anything with it. So I need that kind of authority, clinical decision making person that I can take this to. Absolutely. So they can help me with that.
And Cotter talks about that. He writes about that in his book Accelerate, where he talks about, you know, networks and hierarchies coexisting, and that's a prime example of QI tends to be done in a very kind of network fluid manner, bringing together people. But how do you connect that network to the hierarchy when you need that leadership and you need some of that decision making? And you know, we have those hierarchies in the NHS. There's no way of getting around that. But it's trying to understand, how do we use that to achieve our aim? How do we use that to get to where we want to be, and see the positive opportunities, rather than saying, oh, you know, that's a barrier, management are not engaged, or they, you know, we can't engage with them, as maybe how some people feel as well. But it's understanding what your opportunities to kind of connect those two.
Yeah. And just listening, you know, so leadership, and a big, like a core competence of leadership, I think, is influencing. And this is where that can really come into its own, can't it? That ability to be able to negotiate and influence and broker relationships, isn't it, between the frontline teams, who are the ones that are often doing the doing, or should be doing the doing, because, you know, there's this age-old thing around, you know, QI is done to us, and we, you know, so it's moving away from some of those things. I mean, we could be here all day, and I mean, to be fair, you've got you've got a whole, how many series to talk about these sorts of things? So, it's great stuff. So I think, so in terms of just surmising where we are now, just to help me keep my head on track as well, we've talked about what QI is, and we've talked about that in those important first two steps. And I love that model for Improvement Plus. And I think what would be great, and we've referred to one of the questions that we were asked. We've got a couple of questions in that we had through Twitter, and I'm just looking through them now. And a lot of them actually are around kind of measurement. But there's one that was asked by actually Gemma Stacey, Professor Gemma Stacey, who's the Deputy Chief Executive of the Florence Nightingale Foundation. And I actually think, and the reason I bring up Gemma's question in particular is because she asks how you define success in QI. And I think it's something we kind of started to kind of teeter around the edges, you know, during our conversation. And I think, again, this is probably a really important thing. And you said, you referred to what good looks like. And I wonder, is that the same as defining the success of QI, and how you maybe can go about starting to do that?
That's a really interesting question. And when I seen that, my mind kind of was racing with lots of different. So I think you could boil it down to success is whatever you define good looks like in the context of QI.
Yeah.
And to your context, your organisation or your team or whatever, that's a bit kind of loose. So I would say at an organisational level, what success might look like is, you know, is it happening? Is there a culture of QI in terms of that's the way that you solve problems? You don't just jump in and based on assumptions, as we're saying earlier, and make the change, but there is a kind of deliberate kind of structure in place to bring a problem and start to work it through to address that need. Success for me would be evidence that you're learning from that QI. Now, that might not always be we've fixed this thing and it's done and that's us, we can move on, but what are we learning? Our system is constantly changing, no more than it has over the last 3 or 4 years, certainly in the NHS. So you're never quite done with, you never reach a kind of successful, you know, here's the line in the sand, we've finished it, this is binary success or failure. But are you learning from that QI activity? That's success for me. Learning from what goes well and what goes wrong.
Oh, that's hugely important, isn't it?
Yeah, not only what is it we want to do, but we've learned that we can't do that or we shouldn't do that, and let's now take that off the table and not waste any more time thinking about it.
Mm.
But for me, and the role that I'm in at the minute as a head of QI, success is that it's happening deliberately. Mm. It's not happening just because. There is a structure in place in your organisation that people go, I want to make something better and I'm going to do it using this methodology, this approach, these tools, etc., etc.
Yeah, I like that. I like that it's happening deliberately. And I guess ultimately, Jonathan, there is no one size fits all, is there?
But
the key thing is what you've just described around having those specific measurable goals, objectives that maybe are aligned with the organisation's vision and mission, to make sure everything's kind of like feeding into the same direction that the organisation is going in.
Absolutely.
And so that everybody's very... So Brené Brown is, one of the great thought leaders, and she says, so one of the things we often talk about is this clarity and this... So, having that sense of clarity is the same sort of thing here that we're talking about. If you haven't got that sense of clarity, people need to understand what good looks like. They need
Absolutely.
To feel it, don't they? They need to experience it for themselves. So all of what you've just talked about. And I guess the other thing I keep saying at the moment, or have been for a while now, is context is king to all of this, isn't it? The landscape and the context is the thing that will define that, will help you to define that success.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a favourite phrase of mine, is context is king. I think we're in that kind of reality where we have to start and take the world as it is, not as we'd like it to be. And that's where we have to begin, by defining what that success looks like. And we've got lots of constraints and lots of challenges in the healthcare system, health and care system, at the minute. So, we have to be realistic in defining what that success looks like. But at the same time, yeah, we can be aspirational.
Mm.
And I truly believe that QI, alongside other methodologies, transformation, the human factors, coaching, all these different kind of ways of kind of changing the system, if it's done properly, if it's given the time that it needs, then it can deliver what you want it to do.
Yeah, no, I think that's great. So, I mean, there's so many questions here, but we will do our best to try and kind of answer these. And I think, off air, before we started recording, I kind of pitched the idea to you that maybe we should pull together just a little kind of leaflet, so we're able to go into some of this stuff in a little bit more detail, because it's really hard to cover it all off otherwise this could be hours and hours long podcast. And as much as people might like to dip in and out of that, I don't know that that's the best approach to this. But one of the there's a couple in here around, actually a lot of those questions I felt were very much around measurement and outcomes and all that sort of thing. There was also something in there about culture, and I think we'll touch on that. But there was one from Rebecca Aylward, who I know is an executive deputy director of nursing in Cardiff and Vale University Health Board in South Wales, and she asked, and this was a real kind of like, because I am both into QI and I feel I'm quite a creative person. So I'd love to get your view on this. So she asked, can QI get in the way of creativity?
I mean, no more or less, I think, than any other kind of methodology or approach. So And again, I think it depends about who you have in the room and your kind of fidelity to that. So, so QI, and this has been said lots of times, I don't know who quite coined this kind of description of it, but if we take QI as 100%, we can split it down to kind of 20%. The technical tools and the methodology, so some of the tools and things we've spoken about, but actually the vast majority of is relationships, and the relationships that we have with people, your pals that you get together to do your project, and people across the system, and I think that that's where the creativity comes in, those discussions, you know, with the hopefully having the right people in the room and identifying the right people and bringing people in, but those discussions and being open to what people have got to say, what their experience is, and not necessarily, you know, closing that down. Maybe taking a more kind of generative, curious approach to that discovery with coaching questions. The QI purists that maybe listen to this might balk at this, and I do see myself sometimes as a QI purist because I always start out with that ultimate fidelity to the methods and the tools. But if you think a tool is going to get in the way, or how you might structure something using a tool is going to get in the way of actually that innovation, that creativity coming through, then adapt, amend, you know, change how you're kind of developing that, because it shouldn't get in the way. It shouldn't get in the way of being creative. It should actually be the vehicle for driving that creativity. Your theory of change that you should be basing pretty much all of your QI on, whether it's your driver diagram or your logic model, that should have everything in it. It should have the wacky, the crazy ideas, as well as those level one evidence-based peer-reviewed journal, this is what you have to do, all the way right down to, wouldn't it be great if we gave all the patients a iPad and got them to, you know, all those kind of crazy things. And they should be given the same airtime and airspace and consideration as the kind of, you know, the route one things that we have to do. But for me, that creativity question, and that's what I kind of jotted down, that's the relational part. And you have to absolutely give that all the time and space that it needs.
Yeah, no, I agree. And actually, I think being the creative person I am, I don't know that. I mean, I've felt at times maybe it's about how, if you've got a well-structured QI program, I think it can enhance actually and support creativity. And I think you're absolutely right. You need to pour that creativity into some of those structured tools, isn't it? Like a driver diagram and all those other things. But, you know, if we want to, you know, if we fundamentally want to change what we do, you know, instead of just continuing to do things just a little bit better. If we fundamentally want to change, surely creativity's got a part to play in that.
Absolutely. And you know, another one of the phrases I like to use is, you know, we don't want the tail to be wagging the dog. And if we take that kind of, you know, we're focusing that 20% technical tools, and we're having that, you know, QI workshop, and we're having a discussion, and say we're doing a process map, and somebody goes, oh, what about this? We don't want to be saying, well, we can't capture that on a process map. It's a good point, but thank you very much. Because that is the tail wagging the dog. What we want to say is, yeah, we're going to write that up. We're going to capture that. It might not now look like a process map, but it doesn't matter because we're getting to something here, or a fishbone diagram, or whatever it might be. So we want to be kind of led, I think, by that really those relationships, what people have got to tell us, their experiences. And fit that as best as we can into those tools for kind of understanding and communicating and sharing and getting that buy-in, which is really important, and the outputs from those tools help with that. But we shouldn't do that at, you know,
At the cost of,
yeah, the cost of that innovation, at the cost of that creativity.
There can be a risk with that, can't there? I've worked with some, you know, sometimes that those QI purists can sometimes maybe can hinder that, but often you can find your way around that, can't you? As long as you have a
Yeah,
conversation and.
it's that point that we were saying, we were discussing the idea of doing some kind of, you know, frequently asked questions leaflet, is that you know, you have the textbooks that describe how to do quality improvement and change, and they're kind of based on an idealized, world, the theory is great, but actually you and I both know, and lots of people listening to this podcast will know, that when you do QI in a kind of pragmatic, practical way, that's just not how it works. You can't get everything looking the way that it should be. You don't use every tool that you should use in sequence. You do the best that you can to get to that outcome that you want. And that's ultimately what's important, is that we've made the system better for our staff, for our patients, and we're able to actually describe how we do that so that it can be scaled up and replicated.
For sure, definitely. So there's quite a number of questions that kind of came through. They're asking about measurement just in different ways, I guess. And then there's a couple around culture. So I think just to kind of take us through this next kind of part of the podcast, because as I am trying my best to keep us, there may be that, Jonathan, we may need to sit down again at some point if the listeners are keen to hear a part two. They already asked for part two with Tom Gearty, so I don't, I think there's a big concept, isn't it, to try and explain in one episode, so which is why you've got a whole kind of couple of series dedicated to QI. But so there's a couple of years. So Evelyn Prodger, who actually has been a guest on the Leadership Log podcast, lovely Evelyn, she talks about how we measure those softer interventions. So like kind of like story telling. And then on the other end of that, we've had a question from Tasmin Bicknell-Morrell. I hope I've pronounced that correctly. And she talks about how do we apply our QI principles and measure to hard to measure projects. So there's like this two, so you've got the softer measure, the softer side. How do we measure, I guess, the what we would refer to as qualitative stuff, I guess, in some respects, is the experience, which is very difficult to kind of nail down, isn't it? And then some of those harder to measure projects, how do we apply some of the QI principles to a harder to measure projects? And then the other thing was very much then about impact and dissemination. So how do we actually use what we're measuring, what we learn, what we gather, and then use that for scale and spread across the health and care sector? So I guess there's and that was asked by Lucy Brown. So Lucy Brown also works for Florence Nightingale Foundation. And so I guess there's something new about how do we measure the softer stuff? How do we apply this whole thinking of QI to those kind of hard to measure projects? And then it's around how do we use what we've learned and disseminate that? And Alexander Doyle, who actually is a fellow scholar and works on the Leadership Blog podcast with me, asked how we can better communicate the benefits and the outcomes to kind of these disparate groups. So there's something about how do we measure, and there's something about how do we disseminate what we've learned.
So I wonder if those two questions about measurement are actually talking about the same thing. Because often the hard to measure interventions are the softer qualitative data. So if it's quant data, it's fine, because you can look at a dot on a chart and see which way it's moving, and you can start to gain some insights about your improvement activity. But things that are more about care experience, satisfaction, those types of things can be a wee bit more difficult. So measurement is always the one aspect of QI that I think people get anxious about, struggle about. And that's been my experience mentoring people on QI education programs and people doing QI work in systems. And it's this, it's the second question for most people, the third question for me and the model for improvement, which is, how will you know that change and improvement? So it's a big part of that kind of framework. And lots of people come to it with the, I'm not good at maths, I'm not good at numbers, and, they get really anxious. The good answer, or the helpful answer, is you don't need to be. there's lots of tools out there, and there's lots of simple ways for you to be able to count and visualize that stuff so that you can understand your measure over time and do that variation piece. So my message to my first message to people about kind of measurement in relation to QI is chill out. It doesn't need to be perfect. It just needs to give you enough of an insight into how your QI activity is working. There will be other data and measures, and we'll touch on that around the communication piece, that maybe do need to be perfect, but they're going to be different from your QI measures and the things that you might be measuring as part of your QI activity. The other thing to say is that not everything that you're looking to change needs to be measured. Okay, so some things don't need to be measured, and that's where storytelling comes in. That's where experience comes in. Someone might say to you, well, when I received this service, it's, you know, I've got all these problems and I've got all of, you know, these difficulties and challenges, and it would be better if this was changed and that was changed. And you might get that information through a survey or through a focus group or whatever, but that can be quite hard to then quantify. But you still might get a lot of that where you can then go and make changes and improvements and do things. The measure of success for that is that, you know, you either go back to that same person or you have new people that come through your service and they say, well, it's better, it's improved, and this has changed, and that's more helpful now, and et cetera, et cetera. And that's where the power of storytelling is really important to QI, and telling that kind of that journey alongside your kind of quantitative data and your run charts and your SPC charts and all of these things that can bamboozle people and put people off until they're kind of demythologized and folk can get a handle on them. So that's really, really important. But again, it is that thinking about creative ways to measure and tell that story, and actually being comfortable that we can change some things, but we might not have that kind of hard measurement of you know, a before and after quantitative number. I had the pleasure of listening to Dawn Berwick speak a couple of years ago, maybe less than a couple of years ago, at an LFE conference, and that was the message that he gave. And he related it to the fact, he's like, you know, I've been married, happily married for 30 years, he'd said, and he has kids and he has grandkids, but he doesn't give his wife a survey every year, you know, and ask her to fill that in and measure how happy she is with the marriage. But equally, you know, through that, again, that relational side, that discussion, he would know how things are going and maybe how he has to change and improve. And that really kind of struck me as, well, you know, absolutely, that's right, because we can end up down a kind of rabbit hole of how do we measure this? We need a chart. We need something. Yeah. We need to quantify. We need to justify the change we've made and why it's better. Sometimes it just is, and we know and we feel that in our bones, and we feel that in the stories that people tell us and that we can relate to other people. When it comes to communication and the question around communication, you know, I think good QI needs a comms plan. It needs to be thought about upfront when we're talking about getting our group together, our team, our pals, and kind of thinking about who within that system. We spoke about the RACI tool as a way of kind of defining which stakeholders need to be communicated with and how they need to be communicated. I think that absolutely needs to be part of your kind of setup for your QI work. I think you need to be communicating throughout your change and improvement work, absolutely at the end of that. But I think you need to be letting folk know, this is what we're learning. These are the changes that we're making as we go along. And this is how you can get involved. This is what we need you to do. So I think we need to be communicating as we go along, both when we're doing that kind of testing and prototyping, all the way up to that scalability and spreading. If we're drip feeding that communication and we've got a really good communication plan, that's going to make that scale up and spread and dissemination so much easier, because people will know it's coming rather than doing that big bang communication to say, hey, for the last 9 months, we've been doing a QI project and we found all these things and now you need to do them. Isn't that great?
Yeah.
Because, you know, because humans don't necessarily react that well when we're told, this is what you have to do. You know, we go there, oh, is that right, pal? We'll see about that.
We'll see about that. Yeah, thank you very much.
And I've seen that happen at every level of an organisation, ward to ward, hospital to hospital, hospital to national organisations, you know. So yeah, that comms and dissemination piece, I think, needs to be kind of baked in at the start. And again, the scale of the change that you're doing will determine that. That might just be talking about it at your safety brief in your ward and making sure that your colleagues know about it. But it also then might be, if it's big organisational change, sitting down with your colleagues in comms and saying, how do we get this into the comms pieces that we've got in the organisation, the newsletters, the briefs, the different things that will keep people aware of what we're doing if it's that large scale change. But it could be as simple as 5 minutes at the end of your safety brief. This week we're testing, doing our medication round a new way. You know, it could be as simple as that.
Yeah, I think that's, I think that's essential. And it's about communicating, isn't it? You know, your clear measures and how you've established that and what the data is telling us. And I love that idea of that, like, kind of comms plan running alongside your improvement program and making sure that you're engaging in that knowledge transfer almost, isn't it? Or consistently through the life span of any kind of QI project. Mm-hmm. And because it's all about collaboration, and key to collaboration is communication. The other thing I think is very clear from what you've said is it's not just numbers, it's numbers and narrative. So
absolutely,
numbers and storytelling is so, I mean, I'm a huge advocate for storytelling. And again, it's one of the core competencies of a great leader is being able to tell a story that galvanizes people into a place of wanting to take action. And that's a huge thing to do with QI, isn't it? So you can discover what a problem is. You can come up with a bunch of solutions. But if you can't motivate and inspire and galvanize people into that, so that, you know, it's the will, ideas and the execution, isn't it? And the execution
absolutely
normally fails because of that motivation and that kind of that inability to mobilize that tribe. So, you know, trying to bring everything together, you talked about finding pals. Lots of people refer to it as your tribe, like our lovely friend Blue Waters loves to call it a tribe, doesn't she? And so but it's about how you can mobilise those individuals in a way that they feel connected to what it is that you're doing, isn't it? It's that connection.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's, again, bringing it back to leadership, that's very much the role of leaders within that. Because, you know, they're managing up and down. They are telling that story of what you're doing to the senior managers and the executives within an organisation, but then also kind of providing that leadership down to the guys that are actually making the change. So being able to tell that story in a really concise way, inspiring way, engaging way, is so important. It really is. And it's also important, I think, that storytelling and giving time for that storytelling to happen within the QI team is really important, because sometimes that storytelling is just as informative, if not more so, about the system and the things that need to change than, okay, let's fill in this template or let's use this tool. So giving that time and space to get that story, that data from professionals, multidisciplinary professionals, but also that's, and we mentioned it earlier, that's where your patients, your families, your carers, where their stories are really, really important, and seeing things from a different lens. And anybody who uses the kind of big room methodology from the Flow Coaching Academy will know the power of having patients in the room with the team when you are doing that kind of discovery and define phase around improvements you're going to make. And again, how patients, family members, etc., can really test the assumptions of what's working well and what needs to change. From that kind of, you know, professional point of view, we have our views and what needs to happen, and it can sometimes be kind of diametrically opposed to what's important to patients.
Well, they're the ones that feel that, you know, when we talk about impact, you know, by and large, the impact of any change initiative, QI project, whatever you want to call it, whatever language you use, fundamentally ends or with our patients and our families. So,
absolutely,
you know, absolutely, we should be. But it's interesting, isn't it, that you need a maturity within an organisational culture to create that psychological safety for staff to have patients in the room, to be able to have those open and honest and transparent conversations, isn't it, that are going to help to
absolutely affect that change. I think that's massive, and I think that makes a lot of people really uncomfortable, and and I can understand why. I heard a great thing, and I've kind of tried it a few times, and I tend to get funny looks. Was Jeff Bezos, obviously the kind of founder of Amazon, when he was having his executive kind of team round the table, and they were looking at how they could improve, you know, the Amazon services, they would always have a chair that wasn't filled by a member of the executive team, and that represented the customer.
Oh, wow.
You know, so that represented who they were doing this work and service of if they couldn't have them in the room. So it's maybe even an idea of those healthcare teams that maybe aren't quite ready to have the patient in the room, is how do you kind of actually represent the patient in the room and have that pause and reflection to say, okay, because at the end of the day, we're all patients and service users as well. We might have our professional hat on, but we've all used healthcare services to one degree or another, and we all have that experience as a patient. So having that time to kind of reflect, and however you might want to do it, the empty chair or the patient in the room, is really important. And I think it strengthens again everything that you're planning to do and move forward.
Absolutely. And I think you've just triggered my thinking there. I don't know if you've heard of something called an empathy map. So that's another tool that you can use to bring that patient persona into the room. So you've got that anchor point of, you know, what, you know, why are we doing this? It's purpose. It comes back to purpose, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
So at a risk of just ending up going down another rabbit hole, I'm going to bring us round to, because I think that leads quite nicely into this kind of, there were two questions that I think link into culture. I know you've picked these up as well. So there was a question, there was a second kind of question from Evelyn, which was about tips for engaging staff in helping to make QI language a part of that daily business. And a very similar question from a lady called Jo Campbell, who asked, how do we formally make QI a part of nursing culture? So what's your views on that, on those two kind of questions?
So I'll take the language one first. It's really interesting because not that long ago, as part of a kind of development session around improvement for improvement staff, we held a mock presidential debate on the subject of QI language. So we had two candidates. We had one who was arguing for QI language and one who was arguing for not using that and the detriments. I think there is something about QI professionals like anybody else. It's our professional language. So we want to use that and talk about that, just in the same way that nurses and pharmacists and doctors all do. But I think what we need to recognise is that nurses and doctors and pharmacists don't necessarily use that language when they're engaging with the patient. So I think there's something about how do we as QI professionals kind of soften that language and that use of language to kind of bring people along with us. Because there's no doubt, you know, if you read logic model, driver diagram, force field analysis, people are going to go, what? Yeah. What is that? What is that all about? So, you know, there's different kind of practical and simple ways that you can do that. First of all, is have a conversation. You know, do you have a forum in your organisation to bring people together and discuss these things, you know, and have a chat about these and try to kind of, you know, demystify them. Having a glossary, you know, what does a driver diagram mean? You know, means this. Having something that people can reference alongside some of those QI reports or some of those discussions. That translation. You know, we often talk about the use of critical language and patient safety and kind of getting terms and words that are almost kind of like canned text when I say this, it means I need this or I need that. So can we
Mm-hmm.
get that around QI? Can we have something where we describe something like this in very simple terms, but what it actually means is back to the kind of professional technical language of these tools. So I think there's lots of stuff like that, but it comes back to that idea of the relational side of QI, having conversations with people, being transparent, being collaborative, and just having that discussion. And you're kind of slowly going to break down those barriers.
Yeah.
The culture one is a big, that's a big one, isn't it?
Of
You
course,
know,
yeah.
because culture, that change in culture kind of comes about through doing all of the things that we've been talking about, you know, doing QI deliberately in your organization, having deliberate structures and infrastructure in place and people in QI roles that make QI visible to your staff so that they can A, become aware and understand what it is, but they can engage with it. It is going to drive forward culture. I think there's something as well about where QI or change, not necessarily because QI kind of conjures images of specific methodologies for some people, but that change, how do we get that in a consistent way into undergraduate? Because a lot of the lead level QI programs are kind of, you know, postgraduate people that have been in post for a long time. They've been a nurse, they went through the hierarchy, they went through the hierarchy of midwife, and then they go out and do these kind of QI programs. But how do we get newly qualified staff, whatever discipline, coming in and getting exposure to that straight away, but actually also maybe having some exposure to that when they come in. So, you know, I'm thinking like medics, junior doctors have to do a QI project as part of their, you know, their foundation training years. Do we have an equivalent for nurses when they're out on placement? You know, and some of those placements are rather, you know, 2 or 3 months. So are we asking them to identify an area for improvement and maybe get involved or do some leading around that? You know, what kind of QI education are they gonna get in their undergraduate? If people are coming in to post with an idea of how to make those changes when they see something that maybe isn't what they would like, a standard that they're not happy to accept, that's going to make this thing happen so much quicker because we're going to have a bigger critical mass of people in our organization that can actually undertake quality improvement. And that's, you know, when people talk about creating the conditions for QI, you know, that's a big part of it is that capacity and capability. And getting people the knowledge and the skills to be able to do this. Because so much of the changes we're talking about, you know, are, I mean, they're aware, staff on the front line are aware of them. So how do we empower them to just go and make that wee process tweak, that wee change that could impact efficiency and productivity? And when we're talking about measures earlier, if people are doing that and they're constantly adapting to the system's needs and the patient's needs, then that's going to be borne out in the data, some of our audit data around our productivity and our efficiency and some of our quality measures. We're going to see those all moving in the right way if there's more people within our organizations, you know, kind of pulling that hand on rope, you know, that kind of literal or figurative rope in healthcare, and making changes to that process, that's going to filter up.
I couldn't agree with more of that. I think, you know, it's about that making every contact count, isn't it? Build it into the personal development review process. You know, we started this conversation talking about how we have to do these different leadership programs, and as you know, not how we have to do, that's not the right word. We do these leadership programs because we want to, because we want to grow. And as a part of that, we are asked to do you know, so I'm trying to change my language myself here now. We're asked to do these QI projects. And it's just about helping people to connect those two things and not see them as separate entities. Because I do think sometimes that separation and that siloing of like, this is QI, this is leadership, this is nursing, you know, this kind of like siloing of things. And it's that richness. You know, it's the tapestry of being a nurse requires you to be a leader. It requires you to be able to do quality improvement, because ultimately what you're always striving for is better outcomes, however that might be, through your leadership, through working collaboratively with the team, through the connections, through the networks, through all of the stuff that we've kind of talked about as much as we can in this episode. And I think, you know, there are some key steps that nurse leaders can follow to help to embed and ingrain that kind of stuff. And some of the kind of demystifying is always really good as well, isn't it? And I think we're experiential people as nurses and midwives, and we need to experience it. So to believe it and to understand it sometimes is about experiencing it. And there's no better way to do that than put people together and learn from each other, isn't it? That shared experience kind of connects people, doesn't it?
When I undertook the Scottish Improvement Leader Programme, you know, we had to have a project and we're kind of applying our learning to the project. And that's the way that it was structured, was your project was a way of kind of evidencing what you were learning. So they were intrinsically linked. And you have to produce a poster about your learning and your project at the end of that. And one of my biggest pieces of learning was from the kind of pragmatic application of this stuff in practice, and that experience piece, because that's where you really got to learn. You can read the books, you can do the modules, you can go in the courses, but actually doing this in the real world, with all the constraints and all the challenges that we have in healthcare, will benefit you more and give you more confidence as well in terms of moving forward with QI, because there's a big bit about confidence and leading QI as well than, you know, just reading the books alone and helping you to know when you push, when you don't push, what you use, when you use it, etc.
That's a great way to end the, you know, for us to bring the conversation to a bit of a close, because we would be here forever, but I'm already thinking we may need to do an episode on leading change and kind of tease out some of the nuances around kind of leading change, because that leans into that whole cultural part, doesn't it, around, you know, how do I formally make QI part of, you know, a nursing culture, and kind of that's very much about leading change and some of the communication stuff we've talked about of making that impact, influencing, brokering, all of that stuff that kind of
absolutely
leans into that leadership arena. Jonathan, do you know what? It's just so delightful to talk to you. Your passion for QI just radiates, and it's infectious. And so it's no wonder that you're head of quality improvement. And they're very lucky to have you. And now I'm very aware all of a sudden, but I hope you know our podcast episodes enough to know that before we let any of our guests go, we ask you, and I feel like I'm putting you on the spot here, but we ask you to consider three guests that you would invite to dinner, dead or alive, real or fictional. I wonder who you might invite. And I do appreciate that I completely forgot to give you the heads up on this one.
That's good. Route one, I'd probably go for Deming. Edwards Deming, who a lot of this, you know, that we've been talking about, you know, is based in the work that he did. So I think it would be really interesting to kind of get his view on it and maybe find out what he thinks of where we're at just now with change and improvement, would be really interesting. The other one, there's a gentleman called Dick Strawbridge. I don't know if people will know him. So there's a TV program called Escape to the Chateau. Some people might know that.
Yes.
So I love that program.
Right.
It's just recently finished. So Dick is an ex-army man, but he's a kind of engineer. He's a jack of all trades. And him and his wife bought this French 15th century chateau that was in a sorry state. And by the end of the program last year, they've completely renovated it. And I just find the guy fascinating, amazing, inspirational, because his wife comes to him with all these crazy design ideas and he just goes, okay, scratches his head and says, well, how can we make this work? And he goes and does it all.
Right.
You know, everything from the plumbing to, you know, how things look and rejigging rooms, And his approach to kind of problem solving and getting people together and his collaboration and all that kind of stuff, I just, you know, I find him very, very inspiring when I watch him. The third one is probably going to be a non-QIA type change person, but it would be Bruce Dickinson, the lead singer of Iron Maiden. And you know, kind of for the, so I'm a huge, Iron Maiden's my favorite band. Bruce is just a fantastic singer, but he's a polymath. So he's not just the singer of this massive you know, heavy metal band, but he's also an airline pilot, you know, and he's flew commercially and flew charters and all that kind of stuff. He's a fencer, and he's done fencing professionally, and I think just again just last year he was involved in championships. He does a podcast, so he does all these things. He's a really fascinating guy. So, you know, it brings such a wealth of experience and knowledge around different subjects. So I think he would have some roaring stories to tell us all that once we'd listened to Mr. Deming and Mr. Strawbridge.
Well, do you know what? Those are three great guests and guests we've not had before. So it's always good to get some new guests in there. So I think that would be quite an interesting dinner party, you know. I think there'd be some great stuff. I wonder how, like, Deming and Bruce Dickinson, would get on. I wonder what he'd have to say about the whole fencing. And already I'm like kind of hearing some human factor stuff in there as well. If you're thinking about like the QI,
some strange interactions, I'm sure.
Yeah, but it sounds like a great dinner party. I always want to come to people's dinner parties when I hear who their guests are. Listen, Jonathan, it's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you today. I really do think that it's a great starting point. And I say starting point because I know there's so much more that could have been covered that we just haven't got the time to cover. And I think even more so now at the end of our conversation, I really think it would be great if we could work together to create this kind of like real world, you know, kind of answer and question type of leaflet for people. So hopefully, you know, that's something we can put out when we, well, actually, I'd like to put this episode out quite quickly because I think it'd be really helpful. But yeah, we'll definitely work on that so you don't quite get rid of me that easily. So listen, all that remains really is for me to thank you, Jonathan. Thank you for your time and for your insights and for your passion. Like I said, it's contagious. So I thank you. And to thank our listeners for listening. So until next time, it's goodbye from Jonathan.
Goodbye. Thanks for having me, Becky. It's been wonderful.
It's been my pleasure, and it's goodbye from me. Thanks for listening to the Leadership Blog, where we're navigating everyday leadership. This is a non-affiliated podcast, and any views, thoughts, and opinions expressed by the hosts or guests belong solely to them, and not necessarily to their employer, organisation, committee, or other group or individual. Thank you.